This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, pull language out of its hay-lined hibernation box because it's time to wake up for a new year of Allusionist. 3 years done, 400 to go. Today's show contains references to the current president of the United States of America, and I know a lot of you listen to this show for a little escape from politics and the news, so I just want to assure you there is not much modern politics in the episode. It's mostly about history and interesting word facts, so do persist. On with the show. It's a year since Donald Trump was inaugurated as the 45th president of the United States. And in that year, he's caused a lot of changes in the job of constitutional law professor Elizabeth Joh, for instance.
It turned out that every single time I taught con law or taught a particular class, I had to go and check Twitter. Because if I didn't, there was a good chance that I had probably missed something that President Trump had said. And so it became a kind of additional part of my class preparation to say, well, you know, here is something that the president tweeted. I had to immediately screenshot it. And then we would spend a few minutes in class dissecting the president's tweets, what they meant for constitutional law, a task I could never have imagined a decade ago.
And here's another issue she could not have imagined a decade ago, a particular linguistic issue.
Yeah, one of the things that often comes up, particularly in a constitutional law course, is the idea of what happens when you have two laws that seem to address the same topic. They can't be complied with simultaneously. One has to give. Well, for most of my teaching career, I've used a particular verb. I say, well, class, when we have this kind of situation, according to these legal rules, one trumps the other. And until our particular and current president took office, this was something I said unthinkingly. And then after January of 2017, I realized that the very first time I said, well, as you know, class, this means that one law trumps the other. The class sort of erupted in titters. And I thought, oh my goodness, this has actually happened. Trump has actually ruined the verb that has been so useful to me pedagogically all of these years. And so it's actually taken so much meaning, much more meaning than I ever intended. Trump has changed not just the content of my teaching constitutional law, but the way I talk about it. And so now I am so self-conscious about Trump as a verb, which I never intended to mean to refer to the president, that I actually have stopped using it. And so I've turned to these very awkward phrases, such as, well, when one law supersedes, of course, the other, and that's not very colloquial. It's sort
not
of stiff.
Fun, yeah.
It was awful. And so he's ruined it.
Elizabeth could choose from several synonyms for Trump as a verb in this sense: to best, to outdo, to surmount, to top. But this isn't the point. The point is, this isn't normal, linguistically and politically, for there to be a word that has existed for a while. Then along comes an American president whose name is that word, and overtakes the prior senses of the word. When Abraham Lincoln came on the scene, the city of Lincoln in England did not reevaluate the name it's had in some form for 2,000 years. River crossings remain unassociated with Gerald Ford. And Bill Clinton's face was not on all the cards sold in the 683 branches of Clinton cards that were opened during his presidency. But with Trump, could we be seeing an inverted eponym, the extant non-eponym meaning of the word becoming overshadowed by the person?
I'm trying to think of any examples of that, and I can't pin one down.
And if anyone could think of one, it would be this chap.
I'm Paul Anthony Jones. I write as Haggard Hawks online and on Twitter, and I write about facts about language and etymology and word trivia and all sorts of things.
Such as eponyms, which, as you know from previous episodes of this show, are words derived from a person's name. There are many examples of political eponyms where a politician's name has entered the lexicon.
Probably the most famous one is silhouette. Etienne de Silhouette, in my fantastic French accent, was a French finance minister who introduced really terrible austerity measures at the height of the Seven Years' War in France, sort of mid-1700s. And so because these things were so austere, his name became attached to anything that was done inexpensively or cheaply. And because silhouette portraits are just colourless outlines rather than full-colour portraits, they became known as silhouettes. Just because they were popular at the same time that he was implementing these measures, his name kind of very negatively ended up being attached to them.
It's interesting because you'd never think to look at a silhouette that it was something negative.
Yes.
But something like a guillotine.
Yes.
That's a bit more obviously a diss.
Yes. Yeah, that was Joseph Ignace Guillotin. And he has this reputation, I think, just because of his attachment to the word, of being a kind of Robespierre sort of character, a really sort of bloodthirsty, heads will roll kind of character. And he was nothing of the sort. He was a physician. He opposed the death penalty. He was a member of the French National Assembly, an early proponent of vaccination. He's got all of these positives going for him, but because as a member of the National Assembly, he said that if capital punishment was going to be used, then it should be done in the most humane way possible. And that meant the quickest way possible. So he saw this idea for a mechanism of a falling angled blade and decided that that would be the best way to do it. Put the idea in front of the National Assembly and it ended up having his name. The odd thing is that at the time, the guillotine was also known as the Louisette, because it was invented by someone called Antoine Louis, I think. At the time, it was known by its maker's name, but it's Guillotin's name that's ended up being attached to it. And it's completely changed his reputation in history. I think a lot of people expect him to be a completely different character to who he was, just because of his advocacy for this thing.
So it's kind of unfortunate that someone who was relatively kind and progressive, his relatively kind and progressive form of ending someone's life, has tainted his overall remembrance.
Yeah, it's completely changed his reputation.
That's capital punishment, eh?
Yeah, exactly. Hey, it hasn't got a single silver lining.
Might as well say now that many of the political eponyms are not flattering. For instance, Quisling, a traitor who helps enemy forces.
The really interesting thing about Quisling is how quickly it caught on, over and above a lot of other eponyms, because it was 1940 when Norway fell to Nazi Germany, and the Norwegian government was moved out of the capital and the royal family was moved out of the capital. So there was this real vacuum of power. And Vidkun Quisling he wasn't even, I don't think, that high up the tree. He was an opposition leader, but I don't think his party had much of a following. But he stepped up and essentially staged a coup d'etat and announced on national radio what he was doing, and ended up collaborating with the Nazis for the next 4 or 5 years. But within 5 days of that radio broadcast, there's a record of the Times talking about searching out Quislings in other governments around Europe. Within a week, his name had already been picked up on by journalists in Britain. People were being called Quislingists and Quislingites, and you were being Quisling-hearted and Quisling-brained if you were sort of acting vaguely, traitorously. The story had that much of an impact.
There was even a verb form, to quizzle, which didn't last long, which is a shame because it's fun to say.
I think as well, there must be part of this comes from the fact that people just like words beginning with Q. And that sounds like such a flippant point, but I think the more curious a name is, I think the more people like to pick up on it. I think if he'd been called Johnson, it wouldn't have been quite so quickly picked up. But the fact that it's such an unusual name, to English speakers at least, I think it probably has at least partly to do with his success as an eponym.
Another successful eponym is chauvinism, which entered English sometime in the 19th century, albeit to mean something a bit different to its now dominant sense of sexism, which took hold around the middle of the 20th century.
Chauvinism's a great story, actually, because one thing that doesn't tend to happen with eponyms, or certainly doesn't happen very often, is that the meaning changes. Because eponyms come from people's lives, they tend to be fairly sort of stuck in the language because they'll be associated with one thing that this person's discovered or has invented or whatever it might be. But chauvinism's interesting because it's completely changed. It was originally like a really over-exaggerated blind patriotism, a sort of real nationalism. And it was named after Nicolas Chauvin, who was a soldier in Napoleon's army.
And supposedly fanatically devoted to Napoleon, even after he was injured 17 times fighting in the army, and even after Napoleon abdicated and his ideologies were mud in France. Little is actually known about Nicolas Chauvin. There isn't even solid proof that he really existed. He may have been an apocryphal character. but his name certainly managed to stick.
Originally, chauvinism was just blind patriotism. But in terms of that kind of unquestionable, unfair, very one-sided advocacy for one point of view over somebody else's, the word kind of started to develop and started to broaden so that you can have chauvinism for all kinds of different subjects, and especially now in terms of gender. But it's kind of drifted miles and miles and miles away from the original meaning, which was much more narrow than it is today. So yeah, if Chauvin did exist or not, I'd like to think that he did. I don't think he'd be very happy to see his name attached to what it's attached to today.
Maybe he'd think, well, yeah, I do discriminate against one of the genders. Happy to be that label.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah, he'd be there, you know, thumbs up.
We've learned before that while eponyms are sometimes honorific, other times they really are not. And if it's your name being eponymized, tough, you can't control what happens with your eponym's meaning. And the word itself might even depart from your name quite significantly, as in the case of gerrymander.
I've blogged about gerrymandering before, and I always get comments saying that people thought the guy's name was Gerrymander.
Like Gerald Mander.
Yeah, or like as if he was a Pokemon character, like Charmander. But his name actually was Eldridge Gerry with a hard G.
Oh.
So it'd taken a step even further away from his original name. But yeah, he was governor of Massachusetts, and he signed a bill that redrew the electoral districts in Massachusetts so that they better suited his party to give him a better chance of winning. The ploy worked, his party won. And what ended up happening was that the map of these new districts was used in the press. And I think it's about a dozen of the districts on the left-hand side looked vaguely like a salamander.
Personally, I think that is a bit of a stretch of the imagination.
And if you see this picture, it actually looks a bit more like a sort of vulture with webbed feet. It looks nothing like, it's the most unsalamander-like salamander you'll ever see, but that's just my understanding of amphibians. And they drew this picture around it and said that it was the gerrymander that was sort of creeping its way across Massachusetts. And that's where the word comes from. It was Eldridge Gerry's salamander, effectively. So it's kind of an eponym that's two steps away from the original name. It's pronounced differently because we have more words, or certainly more familiar words in English that begin with a G and an E that have a soft G, like, I don't know, Germ and George and all the rest of it. So it's taken a step away from his name. And then it's had a suffix attached to it. So it's a sort of, it's a portmanteau eponym almost. It's a blended eponym.
A portmanteau eponym? Portmantnym? Epimanteau? There is a presidential eponym coined in 1872, but you don't find it used much anymore. Grantism.
Grantism is nepotism. Really, really extreme nepotism.
Oh.
And it comes from Ulysses S. Grant, who hired about 30 members of his family into his administration, including cousins, and his father was in there, three of his brothers-in-law. He kind of just went through his family tree when he was picking his staff. So Grantism, for the time that he was in power, was real nepotism.
Bear in mind that the term Grantism was coined by one of Grant's enemies, Senator Charles Sumner. That is some trolling by eponym there. Trump, I think, is a name that lends itself to becoming an eponym. It's one punchy syllable, so it would work in portmanteaus. Trumpmander! But it might be a problem that the word Trump already has several meanings. There's the aforementioned verb, to outdo or best, which comes from the noun trump, the term from card games for a card that outranks the other cards. That's been on record since the 1520s. It's an altered version of the word triumph, because there was a card game then named Triumph, which was a bit like whist. And you can easily get that sense in the word of one thing triumphing over another, or trumping another. And when something comes up trumps, that's a successful outcome, so there's that sense of victory in the word too. Then there's another verb to trump, which meant to fabricate. That was from the old French verb tromper, to deceive. And there was an associated 15th century noun, trumpery,
which was falsehood or empty talk or something of less value than it seems.
And then there's the instrument, the trump, a kind of medieval trumpet, which gave us yet another verb sense of trump, which doesn't seem to be in currency in the US, but is certainly used in Britain, to fart.
No kidding.
I think probably in imitation of air blowing through a tube in the instrument sense of the word.
I see.
It's pretty sophisticated stuff, Elizabeth.
I
feel almost ashamed to have enlightened you about this word. Do you have any predictions for what in, I don't know, 80 or 300 years' time an eponym sense of Trump might mean?
Well, if things stand as they are, I just expect that Trump will come to mean something of the qualities we associate with the man himself. A lot of showmanship, a taste for attention grabbing, but sometimes not grounded in as much substance as we'd like, or sometimes not at all, and really a passionate sense of combat for its own sake. And maybe that may be one of the long-lasting legacies he gives to this particular word.
Actually, as you were saying that, I was thinking Trump the man embodies a lot of the qualities of the different definitions of Trump, because there's triumph and besting other things, and also loud blasts of hot air.
So in fact, maybe what we've discovered is that Trump, the word, always embodied what he was anyway. So that was enlightening.
You can hear Elizabeth Joe discuss constitutional law and its latest implications in What Trump Can Teach Us About Con Law, the podcast she co-hosts with eponym fan Roman Mars. In fact, it was Roman who piped up saying that Elizabeth had run into this issue with the verb Trump, and I didn't realise that what he was effectively doing was sneaking in an eponymisode only partway through the annual cycle.
And it's not even my birthday.
Hear What Trump Can Teach Us About Con Law at trumpconlaw.com. Paul Anthony Jones writes about obscure words and etymology under the name Haggard Hawks. He has several books out, and he has a Twitter feed and newsletter that you people will love. Find all the ways to follow him online and devour his work at haggardhawks.com. Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is frisket. Noun. In painting or crafts, an adhesive substance or stencil used to cover areas of a surface on which paint is not wanted. Try using it in an email today. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman, with assistance from Martin Austwick, who also provides the music. You can find the show on Twitter and Facebook. Allusionist Show is the handle. And on the show's website, you can hear every episode of The Allusionist via numerous different means. You can read a load of other material related to each episode and find links to all of the guests. There are episode transcripts, and you can see the full dictionary entry for every single randomly selected word from the dictionary. That is all at theallusionist.org.